Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm doing a show today with the tattooed man, Michael Kester. A living, entire body is just one big tattoo.
Yeah.
I remember when we started this show, I didn't know if you'd ever get a tattoo.
Yep.
What's the count up to right now?
6, but like with 7 paid for.
Okay, so you have more. That's good. That's, I usually run that math the opposite way, and I only have 1.
Yeah.
That is more tattoos than installments of a Killapalooza.
That's true. We have a Killapalooza more of my skin cells, if we want.
Good. Year 11. First Killapalooza on Michael's skin cells. People are digging the Return of the Living Dead Killapalooza.
I dug the Return of the Living Dead Killapalooza.
I want you to know that there's a horror trivia I go to, and I got the article wrong. There's actually a "the" on the beginning.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I go, articles, this is easy. No one in this room is better suited. I do a show a week on whether or not there's an article in the movie title. And we fucked that one up. The Return.
Damn.
See, I'm still doing it. I still came on here today and went, Return of the Living Dead Killapalooza.
Mm-hmm.
As if I can just, I'm gaslighting the title of the movie. I'm going to project a reality in which the Return of the Living Dead is not on the show today.
I was going to say, yeah, you articulated that wonderfully.
But so we don't end the show after 49 minutes. We only open the first chapter. And then for speaking of chapters, 24 minutes into the show, we're going to spoil one of these movies. Let's get that out right away. What are the 2 movies?
Our spoiler fodder for tonight's episode of Double Feature is we're doing a couple mockumentaries, documentary. It's somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point today is to talk about 2 films that are talking about 2 incredibly contemporarily important subjects, but like not in the right way.
but not like in the right way.
Yeah. So we're going to do Edward D. Wood Jr.'s directorial debut, a film called Glen or Glenda, which is one of my favorite things to watch. And then we're going to pair that with a film called Fear of a Black Hat, which is honestly, I'll be completely honest, not a film I had seen.
Oh, really?
But definitely a film that I'm glad I've seen now.
Sometimes I feel like you put things on the show just to kind of prank me.
Yeah.
You just go, I don't know, Fear of a Black Hat.
That show's coming up in a couple weeks for sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's almost the end of the year. Ooh, if this is your first year of Double Feature, you don't know that sometimes the end of the year, increasingly, I would say, this wasn't always the case, but increasingly, is just, you know, we get like 52 good heavy hitter shows in, and then we get a show which still ends up being, substantively a good show,
right?
But the pairing itself is just I don't know how. I mean, I kind of know how this started, but we used to sit down like in coffee shops and just spend hours and hours trying to build a schedule for the year. So this would be the end of the fuse,
right?
You know, sometimes you throw out a pair and it's pretty good, sometimes it's dubious, maybe there's a good conversation, sometimes you're just punchy because it's the 5th hour you've been sitting at this Caribou Coffee or wherever the fuck we were trying to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And we would come up with these shows that were just like, oh, you'll be arrested if you pair those movies together. You just Schindler's List and Tank Girl. You can't put those 2 movies together. Like, that's just illegal. So these are one of those coming up. And that's always one of the most exciting parts of the year for me, is to see what the fuck that magic is, and also how we somehow will manage to turn it into a good show anyways.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel like there's another thing worth mentioning.
Okay.
And that is Double Feature, the podcast, and how it needs money.
Mm.
That's what I feel like is worth mentioning right at the top here before we spoil the movies. We have a Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
You may have heard of this. It's at patreon.com/doublefeatures. Nope. So close. patreon.com/double feature. A single double feature.
A singular double feature.
We should have called the show Double Features, but we didn't have any confidence we'd make it past one episode.
With that fridge, we thought the fridge might get the best of us on episode one.
Oh, man.
For those of you who aren't familiar, there was our first guest on the show was my refrigerator in Chicago.
How you could tell how much I was not into that because we, in the history of the show, we've done 500 fucking whatever episodes. One of them was at your place. Yeah. And the sound quality was so bad, we never did that again.
Yep.
We've recorded in broom closets and all manner of places, never again at your place. So we should start with Glenn or Glenda.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say for everybody who knows, we talked about Ed Wood previously on the show. Everybody's talked about Plan 9. That's the one people know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is true for you because I know you love this film. I actually like Glenn or Glenda the best.
Me too. It's my favorite.
Of the Edward D. Wood Jr.
No question.
Films.
Yeah. No question. Glenn or Glenda is a masterpiece, and it is a film that I have time and time and time again. There's this thing that they do at Drafthouse when Neon produces a film where they do these questions with the director, and they most recently did it with Nacho Vigalondo for Colossal. One of the questions is, if you could remake any movie, any cast, what would you pick?
Oh, hell yeah.
My pick, emphatically, if somebody were like, you can remake any movie you wanted to make, would be Glenn or Glenda. I would want to remake this film, and I would try everything within my power to preserve whatever inanity is going on screen for the full 86 minutes.
Yeah, that's one of the things about the movie. Yeah, I feel like when we talked about Ed Wood, the movie, we talked about it as, you know, here's this character, here's why this guy is so loved, look at his raw enthusiasm. His enthusiasm that, you know, was so much more the fact he had, I don't want to say he had no vision. That's definitely not true. He just he's kind of a crazy guy. I mean, I don't know how better to explain
that. No, I think that there is a better way to explain that. I think that the best way to explain him as a filmmaker is that he's bad at it.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to say that.
I think that he has every component of a great filmmaker aside from a talent to make films.
Yeah, there is just something about it where, you know, you can understand it at a certain level, you can be studied in it, or you can have experience in it. You can come at it from so many different directions, talk to people at so many different levels, have connections, make the movies, but there is some level that is just real-time evaluation of a piece of art you're making. You work on it a little bit, then you step back, look at it, and either go, this needs more work, or is fine. It's totally right. Good. That's what I meant to make.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could step back and go, let's restart it, or this isn't working, or there's compromises, but if you're Ed Wood, you step back and go, well, I guess that's the movie. And that's the part of saying, I guess the easiest way is just to say not good at making movies. I don't know. Because that becomes a sort of more philosophical question of what is it to be good at making a movie?
Mm-hmm.
If Ed Wood makes the exact movies that he plans to make, then maybe he's fine at it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about Ed Wood as a filmmaker is that you don't see filmmakers that are bad at making movies make six movies. He's the exception. He's basically the only recorded evidence we have of somebody who's bad at making movies that you can study, because most people fail. You do one or zero.
Yeah, yeah.
And he went ahead and did like six.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's one of the reasons that I'm so glad that we've already covered the Tim Burton movie on the show, is that it allows for some answers as to how he did that. But this movie in particular is my favorite, not just because of the makeup of the story, but because I have there's a very special place in my heart for a certain aspect of this, which is that you and I come on the show all the time and fellate the fucking exploitation type movies.
Sure.
You know, we love them. And what I love about Glenn or Glenda is that somebody in a studio went, yo, I want you to make a transvestite man in a dress exploitation movie. And Ed Wood goes, yeah, totally. And then exploits that guy by going, I'm actually going to create a really earnest think piece about how sometimes men wear panties and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like a fucking double cross. He's a double agent sure, of exploitation.
Yeah. Well, I also think that today the filmmakers who don't have a lot of natural talent or who just stumble their way through it, it's not that there's definitely more of them just because there's more people making movies, but there's a place in society for that now. There's YouTube and there are places where Ed Wood was learning to make movies as he went along.
Mm-hmm.
We've never so seen the steps of a person what appears to be fucking firing up a camera for the first time, you know, to go on and then understand like narrative structure and things like that. His film school is completely in the public eye.
Yeah.
But there are no Ed Wood films just sitting in his basement no one ever saw. There were right. all movies that came out.
Yeah.
You know, there's no double feature of the movie that it was like, let's nestle this away back here.
Yeah.
There is only the next big Ed Wood movie.
And that's because of a big thing that you and I are familiar with and you're familiar with a lot in the stuff you've been working on too. But that's just because Ed Wood ran into Bela Lugosi once. And so his first movie was this movie and it was Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
If he had never run into Bela Lugosi, this wouldn't matter. But instead he went, I've got Bela Lugosi. And the studio went, he's got Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
It'd be like if you ran into like MC Gainey.
It's I shouldn't say where it is, right? Because that'll allow people to stalk MC
right,
Gainey.
Yeah.
It's as if I had breakfast with MC Gainey on accident every week.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And then he pulled the strings.
Yeah.
I'll start shouting that at him next time and see how he responds.
Oh man.
Yeah, but that's totally it. But I think, you know, that's one of the reasons I love Glenn or Glenda. When you see Plan 9, which is a whole movie based around I had some footage left of Lugosi. Just so ridiculous. One of the things people love about Plan 9 is how just completely all over the place, it's like he's creating an anthology of three movies, one of which is 5 minutes short of feature length. And then there's two other, one is an educational film and one is another narrative film about somebody totally different. And that's Glenn or Glenda.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of Ed Wood's all over the place. What the fuck is this movie? No one makes structure like this. It's just not how you do it at all.
I cannot contain my glee every time it cuts back to Bela Lugosi because there is no point in this film where that needs to be in here.
I know,
but
I know.
It is.
Well, this is a height he should have had to risen to, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, his fifth movie should have been, I finally got Bela Lugosi. What can I make him say?
Yeah.
But instead it was like, whoops, I have Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
What about pull the strings and.
Yeah.
Puppy dog tail. Yeah, that'll be good.
Beware the dragon. There's a dragon. And that's the thing is knowing that this was that all the Bela stuff was shot without there being a movie behind it.
Yeah.
You went, okay, just say some cool stuff, sit in this chair, we'll light you well. I mean, it's lit fairly comprehensively.
It's about as competent as any Ed Wood movie will ever be.
It's this narrative structure where it's like part of this is him himself trying to tell his own story. And then like, that's got its own voiceover, but then that's through the lens of also these two detectives that also have some sort of like,
sure,
like bookends that don't need to be there with all the narration. And then there's literally a puppet master. Like it's basically like he uses all three heavy-handed narrative devices in the same right, story.
Right, yeah. It's almost just made up.
Yeah.
It's all of these bookended narration devices all describing, you know, 6 minutes of stock footage.
Right. And then the thing that I love about this movie the most, I think, is the level of deliberateness that that final tableau where she hands him the sweater.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how you feel
about
this.
You say final tableau and it's halfway through the movie because there's right. an extra movie yeah. tacked on the end.
But I feel like I'm curious how you feel about this, but like mm-hmm. that moment, we it connects for me.
Yeah, no, totally.
It's as if everything about this movie, he's just like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I do know for sure when she hands him the sweater, it's going to feel like an emotional victory. And then it comes up and I'm like, yeah, no, you nailed that. That was dead on. I don't know what the hell is going on in this movie, but I know that that was an emotional victory.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that's really interesting to look at this movie and to think about structure. Because for a movie where it seems like Wood understands that there are structures to movies and sort of taps into them here or there. You know, he knows that a moment like that exists, mm-hmm. that's an important moment to a film,
yeah.
but doesn't really understand, like the idea of three-act structure would be totally lost, but even sure. just any kind of conflict and resolution or, you know, a fucking wave on a paper, you know, yeah. just like draw a picture of a roller coaster, now put beats of the story on it, that's a film, you know, just yeah. the most rudimentary things. But an audience can still watch this movie, and that's one of the great things about Ed Wood is these movies are known when so many movies that have a okay understanding of structure but are not exceptional will be lost to time.
Mm-hmm.
And so for all of the just scrutinizing that people do when they go to movies and the evaluation we all kind of do of a success or fail of what a movie was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
A movie like this can put on a blindfold and just wander through it. And somehow you still go, wow, there's some really compelling stuff in there.
Sure.
Maybe it's not all just the map that's itself compelling.
Part of the reason that I wanted to shoehorn it onto the show this year is because I feel like, man, this movie could be an unsung hero of 2018. I feel like the voice of Ed Wood coming through this film and some of the incredibly ham-fisted things that come out of people's mouths are like, no, not at all. He's not biologically capable of being a woman. You know, it's just the fucking basically medical understanding of being trans versus being a transvestite. And just the care and intent of him trying to, he's just honestly, man, he's trying to get something through to yeah. the American people that like, we still have a hard time getting into the conversation.
Totally.
And I'm just really, I feel like it's a time bomb before all of a sudden people go, holy shit, somebody was talking about this in the 50s.
Right.
And in today's climate, I feel like it could be really important because it is so dumbed down and so like straightforward. You know, I'm curious, like, why are we going Babadook is a gay icon and why not fucking Glenn Glenda?
Yeah.
Like, why isn't Glenn Glenda at the forefront of this conversation in 2018?
Well, even just watching these is such a great study of I've been using the phrase a lot, socially conscious mm-hmm. picture, a socially conscious movie, because that's, you know, to me, maybe it's just the conversations we've had on the show or just something in my history, but that's all I really want to make when I take on like multi-year projects.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, okay, well, there's something in the consciousness, something, some kind of message I want to get out. And that's an early detail that tells me there's a lot here to talk about. There's a lot to be inspired by. I'm going to have mm-hmm. something to say on this. Other people aren't having this conversation. So to me, that's a piece to identify with and go, this is a worthwhile thing to make a project about. Glenn or Glenda gets that little sliver right when so many other movies don't have that kind of piece of ambition. And a socially conscious movie usually gains artistic credibility at the door just for trying to have that conversation. It kind of demands to be taken seriously on its face, which makes Glenn or Glenda such an interesting example because
mm-hmm.
even if all he brings to the table is this passionate desire to have the conversation, there is more redemptive value in that, I think, than making a movie that checks all the right boxes.
Sure.
Or that follows the right formula yeah. or is technically correct in some way.
And I mean, there's a twofold thing for me too, is it's him using his voice, and also he's got a unique voice, and he's coming from a place where he's uniquely equipped to handle this conversation.
This is what I'm talking about.
Insane.
These things seem more important to me
yeah.
than something like structure.
Yeah.
Something like competence, filmmaking
yeah,
competence.
Right. And that's why that's the other reason I love this movie, is that like, it is garbage in all the, as a movie, it is garbage, but as a film, it is just so spot on.
Yeah. I think the takeaway from that is to go, after you've spent all your time watching this movie, is a movie like, you know, Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters,
hey,
or
Hansel and Gretel Get Baked,
Dracula Untold, or, you know, are these movies competent? Sure. Are people going to remember them? I mean, maybe those were Dracula Untold. No one will remember.
I remember one thing from that movie.
Let's throw that movie. Hansel and Gretel was surprisingly gory, so maybe yeah. I don't want to pick on that.
I remember the thing in Dracula Untold where he like bat fist punches the ground.
Bat fist punch. That's the poster you're remembering. That's all it is. I mean, a movie that is competent at the end does not. It's not self-evident that that movie has been worth your time. That's the differentiating factor, I think. To have executed yourself successfully is not to say, good thing you sat here for a couple hours. And Glenn or Glenda goes, okay, well, what if we don't execute successfully, but what if I try and bring up some stuff that has great merit to it, that is very important? And just finding a couple of those moments, even if you end up sitting through stuff that is not only not done, you know, proficiently, but is just kind of obnoxious to, I don't want to say hard to watch, but, you know, that looping stock footage of mm-hmm. welding and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever the fuck is going, it's not even unique stock footage. It's like, you know, it's like a, you're watching a GIF basically of, hey, look, the steel bar goes in. Now some stuff over here pours, the bar is going in again, and it just loops and loops because you got to generate 10 more minutes of footage. Mm-hmm. You will sit through that because then you can watch someone passionately, you know, talk about not even just a sort of explainer or an educational film on transgender issues, and I think more specifically just ideas than issues, but he also kind of takes a stop down to sort of convince you why women's clothes are more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not enough sure. to just go, a film today goes, hey, this is why we should have equal rights. These are some of the challenges transgender people face. It doesn't go, and by the way, man, if you're not wearing women's clothes, let me tell you why it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's spent time and go, you know, that hat, it's cutting off circulation to your head.
Yeah.
You should really try one of these loose fitting hats. And isn't mm-hmm. it nice you can go home and wear, like, that's a ridiculous thing to stop down and do and is awesome. That, you know, if somebody had complete awareness of if they had a laser focus of what they're trying to do with their film, they probably wouldn't get sidetracked just explaining what all of the great, like,
sure.
why it's so wonderful that I go home and wear women's clothes. What's yeah. great about that? Yeah. And why you should do it. You know,
sure.
you too.
Maybe you can do
should
it.
Consider
you
it.
Know, like, consider it. Yeah.
Somebody with focus does not go there, I don't think. And Edward does. This is, it's weird. The particular episodes that we have difficulty keeping the conversation to a mere half hour.
Yeah.
I feel like I didn't even realize I had this much to say about
yeah, same.
Ed Wood. I wrote down Fear of a Black Hat in my notes for some reason as Who's Afraid of a Black Hat, which is also a great.
Who's Afraid of Virginia's Hat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So look, before anybody says what the fuck about this movie.
Yeah.
It debuted at motherfucking Sundance, all right?
Hell yeah.
So this is, you know, I mentioned the title specifically because you might know a little bit more about this too. This is a fun thing we discovered when we were doing the double feature movie. But you and I both went from listening, you know, purely to like...
white people music?
well, you know, 90s alternative that we grew up with. And I think a lot of trip hop at the time.
Mm.
And then we both started listening to hip hop, but just completely different brands of hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I remember getting in your car in Texas and being like, I recognize what kind of music all of this is, but I have no idea who any of these people, just hours and hours of airport driving. And just like, I have no idea who any of this is.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be able to fill in a couple of the blanks on this show here.
Mm-hmm.
But Fear of a Black Planet, I believe is Public Enemy. Okay.
Yeah.
So Public Enemy is East Coast, which is maybe that's the difference. Not today. Not today is just like different subgenres or whatever, I think.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to have a lot of East Coast holes in my knowledge, but I've always loved the sort of, I guess, poetic quality of the phrase Fear of a Black Planet.
Yeah.
Something about that is so emphatic and so bold and so well adapted to just say fear of a whatever planet. Like it's just, you could just put anything there and it just becomes such a great iconic phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I like Fear of a Black Hat better than Who's Afraid of Virginia's Hat or what the fuck ever. Who's Afraid of a Black Hat?
Yeah. This movie to me seems like, and I'm going to throw this out there and then just kind of tear it apart, but it seems like it's something that's capitalizing on Spinal Tap.
Yeah. I would totally agree with that. I think that's part of the Sundance.
Yeah.
I think they saw so clearly what the movie's trying to do. Unlike Glenn or Glenda, it has such a clear picture of what it's doing.
Yeah.
That they went, oh, this is going to be big. This is a hip hop.
Spinal Tap.
Yeah. I think part of it was also probably that people at Sundance were not hip hop people.
That's what I was thinking is that this is the theme today is that I feel like both of these movies probably made more waves than they thought they would. Maybe not. Ed Wood at some point probably thought it was changing the world
movie of all time. Yeah.
But I don't think that Fear of a Black Planet came out going, we're about to introduce a whole bunch of uptight white people to hip hop culture in a digestible way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's, and this is sort of what I was saying too, is I'm not 100% sure it was effective in doing that in a good way, but it definitely was effective. Because I think that by coming out and being sort of a farce of hip hop culture, it may have allowed for people to be comfortable mocking parts of hip hop culture.
Yeah, right.
Not that this movie's not fucking funny, because it is. But it definitely gives credence and license to a certain level of absurdity that people were probably just maybe a little too willing to hop onto.
Sure.
In 1993.
This almost in a dog whistly way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, it's the kind of movie that comes out and goes, yeah, it is kind of stupid that Flava Flav wears a clock.
Right.
And then
right,
all these other
pull up your pants movie on Sundance.
But I don't think, I don't think it was doing that on purpose, but allowed that because
that's
it was probably
the
first time a lot of people ever really paid attention to 90 minutes of hip hop culture. And it, you know, I see two things in this movie. I see, you know, what you're saying, kind of that dog whistly, like maybe this is the wrong lens. And then I see Pootie Tang.
And
Pootie Tang is a movie that you and I discuss being absolutely inaccessible. And I think that that inaccessibility lends itself to people coming up with simpler explanations for things, such as black people be crazy.
Right. Although Pootie Tang has lost any credibility now when people see who directed it, you can no longer talk about it.
Yeah, that sucks. Because we did a whole show specifically about who directed it.
I was just thinking about that. Yeah, well,
movie's still good. He's just a rapist,
kind
of. He's a rapish.
Wow, you've solved it. You've solved the entire movement. Now we have a word for it and everything. It's just clean that right up. I think... looking at what the movie's trying to accomplish and how it's viewed, there are these questions that come into play that, I don't know, I was going to try and ask this in a more pointed way, but maybe it's better to cover it all through the conversation. You look at what's happening in this movie and say, is it critical of the culture? Or is it a sort of endorsement? Is it celebrating? what's in the culture. And, you know, there's different ways to see if there's a more objective answer to that question. But I also think beyond just figuring out what the filmmakers think, all of those things, you know, through kind of what we've been talking about, apply to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
There is some audience for which this will be a celebration. Isn't it cool someone made a Spinal Tap for our culture? Or people who don't even fucking know Spinal Tap, you know, like, isn't it cool this exists?
Sure.
There is a part of it that plays on this great awakening of hip hop into mainstream culture that scared the fuck out of everybody.
Right.
And so I think to ask a question like, is there a bit of a dog whistle effect that got people to see? First time I ever heard about this movie was in a, I feel the need to say this because you start invoking dog whistle stuff and I feel like I'm pointing fingers and maybe making something insane up. So to back up my claim a little bit here, first time I heard about this movie was in the National Review's Get Out article.
Hmm.
So that just sort of tells you why the fuck I was reading that in the first place is beyond me. But the National Review decided it was time to talk about Get Out, a publication that has some dog whistles that have appeared in it
mm-hmm.
previously. And so the fact that they were hip to it was also kind of like, something interesting's mm-hmm. going on here. But, you know, the audience who is hearing hip hop for the first time, there is a part of culture that's afraid of that. And that still happens today. But when there's these big generational waves of a fear of the other coming in, whether it's a fear of immigrants or a fear of black culture, hip hop was very much that. Oh my God, black culture is invading right. polite white society. And people were kind of looking for something that went, that appeared at least on the surface to be critical of it.
Right. Well, and especially to have a movie that, you know, this kind of, it hits on everything. It's not just hitting on Public Enemy. It's hitting on NWA. It's hitting on, you know, the Ice Cube, Ice-T, like all these people who were like incredibly, incredibly, incredibly influential during the, like the real popularization of hip hop culture, like post Sugar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm saying is it, I think the movie, its heart is in the right place. And this is another conversation that I think we should get into today before we get out of here. But its heart is in the right place, but I just feel like it does too good of a job being parody of these specific aspects of the culture. And it just yeah. pokes a hole in every single thing. I mean, that's comedy and it's precise comedy and it's killer, but I mean, it's dangerous at when the culture is so fresh and just struggling to get a foothold.
Yeah.
It's dangerous to immediately go, this is silly. This is a little silly.
I like that part of it because that's the thing that is the very thing that tips me off and goes, oh, well, these people know the culture so well. They're clearly, in order to write that, you have to really be such a fan sure. of it. You have sure. to follow East Coast and West Coast. You have to know who all these personalities mm-hmm. are. You're writing specific jokes that really cut to the core of what people think about these different things.
Yeah, sure.
And those are the things that over time, I think, still make this movie, still give it a lot of opportunity to
absolutely.
Have bigger conversations today about
yeah.
you know, the overinterpretation of art
mm-hmm.
and when artists claim that something is deeper and whether
yeah.
or not they mean
right,
that.
Right,
and we
right.
can kind of get into some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is something we see today when you see this almost kind of misguided fandom. Captain America is the best example I could think. I was trying to think of something that's more in the wheelhouse of our show.
Mm-hmm.
But you will see anti-immigration debate, people who are against immigration to the United States, very America First people, will use Captain America as an icon to back that.
Mm-hmm.
God, this is going to get so hard without getting super into comic books. Mm-hmm. The only other fucking one I could think of, though, is Superman, which is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, but okay, Superman's easier to explain without going too much into minutia. Superman, is a fucking illegal alien. That's all you need to say. That's an easy way to explain that without going into like backlogs and civil wars and all of this crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't realize that the very icon they're championing, red, white, and blue Superman, is
a rebel.
Not that kind of rebel. Well, it is a fucking immigrant, right?
Sure, sure.
So it's the ultimate story about what an immigrant can contribute to.
You know.
So I get to make the same analogy and even the same fucking colors, basically. Mm-hmm. So I feel good about that. So I think that's what Fear of a Black Hat kind of is for people to, you know, it's not Superman's fault that he appeals to that demographic.
Sure.
And the fact that those people don't get really what is at the heart and soul of Superman is interesting in the same way that I think that is for Fear of a Black Hat.
And that brings me to the probably what will close out our show today. So I hope you have no other notes. It brings me to kind of this point that I think both of these movies have very, very, very interesting and unique versions of this theme, which we hit on a bunch, but always immediately shy away from. But unfortunately, we've got like enough time to maybe talk about it today. Sorry. Just the idea of how much the artistic intent of something matters.
Sure.
Because when you look at, you know, no spoilers, but when you look at the first movie we covered today, we already talked about how his intent is actually the crown jewel of that film.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that translates to a point where like, it doesn't matter how you feel about the movie because his intent translates as this sort of silver beam of light that makes more sense.
Right.
And then you look at, you know, something like, I mean, and the reason I want to talk about it here is that we don't have to talk about it in a meta sense. We can talk about it in the context of the film itself. But, you know, this is a movie about a bunch of characters who their intent is supposed to eclipse their content.
Sure.
And it's sort of, you know, it's the question that they keep getting asked is like, well, I thought this was, you know, Booty Juice was political song. Yeah, it is a political song.
Yeah, right.
And it's that the thing that is, it always eats at me because part of me wants to be like, and it's the reason it kills me is because as somebody who creates art, part of me wants to be like, fuck what the artist wanted it to be. The room is the room.
Yeah.
And then another part of me is like, no, that's not what I meant by that song.
Sure. Well, one of the things that kind of shades my view on this is just the complicated problem you have in how much an audience needs to be factored into the message. Mm-hmm. I mean, you make films for an audience. Films, almost more than any other medium, are, you know, if a film goes unseen in the fucking forest, it might as well not exist.
Mm-hmm.
You put on a big orchestration, so you're doing everything in this kind of medium so an audience watches it. So while I think the artist should stay true to themselves and not worry too much about the audience, you do at least have to worry about the audience enough to go, are they going to get this in the way that I intend?
Mm-hmm.
And also, who is that audience? And how might this look to other audiences? The problem I talked about before, I think, is directly connected. You know, you're making a different movie if you're making it to play at hip hop clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, or in those, you wouldn't really play a fucking movie at a hip hop club, but you know what I mean?
Right.
You have different conversations within your sort of circle and your genre than you would publicly.
Mm-hmm.
You and I can talk all the time off mic about movies we covered and the reasons they may have failed as pieces of art. But on mic, we are broadcasting to other people, and one of the few things that we can bring is to evangelize art.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to be critical of movies on the show the way I would off the show because I think about those things.
Sure, totally.
If you are making a movie, you know, you might make a movie as a champion of hip hop in the late 80s, early 90s,
mm-hmm.
that is critical of the stupid things that genre is doing, as a way to harden it, mm-hmm. to make the genre better.
Sure, that's a Saul Williams tactic.
But you would not want to have that same conversation on a national stage
right,
amongst everybody. Because what you do then is just tell, you know, backwards white folks that hip-hop is silly. Not a valid genre,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So this line has disappeared more and more over time and is the type of thing that, I mean, I feel this in horror a lot too. Like we're critical up to a point. And then when people who decry horror films and think there's no artistic merit to them, I feel the need to house all that, lock it up, and then just talk about, you know, why you're not like workshopping the art anymore at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're just purely defending it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, you have to consider not only how is the audience going to interpret it, but what kind of audience. That makes it even fucking harder. But it's worthwhile kind of, this movie at the very least can invoke that conversation about, okay, well, all of these things are anagrams. Actually, anagram isn't even the right
initialism,
right,
yeah,
a right fucking word, yeah. Yeah.
No, it's not what even are they an called initialism. To? It's the other thing.
They call it an analogram.
Yeah.
By which they mean anagram, which it is not.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I want to make sure I got all the fucking layers. It's almost layered in a way that is evocative of this very fucking problem we're talking about. So I don't know that there really is an answer. I guess I thought about that so much as they're talking about the songs. If they're going, no, you know, each letter of pussy stands for a different word, that is the most BS of any of these claims as an artist. I would be critical to any artists who go, no, this word actually stands for, you know, one of those things you reverse engineer where you pick a word like podcast and you go, no, but it's P.O. You know, it's no, mm-hmm. no one really.
Right.
Oh, and it turns out that spells podcast. Wow, isn't mm-hmm. that really a nice...
Right.
To reverse engineer those things always seems like a wasted effort because it never... It represents the very core of that problem, that nobody's ever going to know the deeper meaning. Nobody's ever going to, you know, see the dots and then feel like, oh, it's clever that that also happens to spell out pussy. They're mm-hmm. going to look at it, go, that says pussy. Most of them are not going to look any deeper than that. And then some are going to go, oh, there's dots. What does it stand for? It's just it's a terribly clumsy way to build art.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to stand all the way at the extreme and go, okay, well, don't make your art that obtuse. But the closer you get to the heart of what you're talking about, the harder that becomes to argue. The closer you get to what if you had an intention and then the audience doesn't see that intention, should the audience be going on an IMDb message board and finding out what you meant by your,
mm-hmm.
you know, your crazy thing? Ugh, God, I don't fucking know.
I know. It's an impossible answer. And it's, to me, it's less about the artist and more about the art. And then it becomes about creating art. And it's, Are you making ripples that people are going to react to, or are you throwing a rock into the pond?
Well, I think there's places for all of this stuff. When I was younger, I thought the most, you know, artistically, the thing that was worth the most applause artistically was a film you could not understand unless you watched it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Now as an adult, I haven't seen a movie twice in like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I still really... find that I really celebrate that thing, but I would be terrified to make something like that for fear that it's lost on everyone and then everybody hates it and nobody watches it.
Right.
But there to have these sort of maybe second levels that are deeper is a redemptive quality to be able to work on some levels and not others. I mean, this is a question that I think the artist needs to solve and not the audience.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that all these artists come to different conclusions. As an audience member, we were just talking about this off air, but I'm trying to work better on coming to a film at its own terms
mm-hmm.
and not going, this is what I've decided as an audience. You know, you need to explain this thing in the beginning and explain this hard enough and
mm-hmm.
answer my questions about these plot holes. I'm just trying to go, well, what is the film trying to tell me? and get the most out of that. But as a filmmaker, I worry a lot about going, you know, when I first started making movies, I would think, okay, well, I just want to meditate on a subject. And if anything I've got going on also rubs off for the audience, great.
Sure.
And the longer I do it, the more I go, is this going to connect with people in the specific way to convey that I'm just setting up little user experience traps for people,
right?
And going, okay, well, I've got this idea about this thing, and I can show it using this metaphor. But once I do that, will the audience sit there and go, oh, this is a clever metaphor because it actually says this, and now I've thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Did that trap work? And what percentage was it successful on?
Sure.
It might be successful on 95%, but then the power of metaphor is lost.
Sure.
Or the power of metaphor lets people who never would have thought about it think about it for the first time, but only 5% of them.
Sure.
That's just a call the artist has to make, and it's wicked fucking hard.
I found by Hollywood standards that if you just do traps that are metaphors for traps and then just have really heavy-handed metaphors for the crimes that deserve the traps, you get 8 sequels.
I was like waiting for, in my head, this is how my recording brain operates. I'm like, as soon as Michael stops talking, I'm going to make a Jigsaw joke as soon as possible. Damn.
Yeah, the key was in your head all along.
We got a website, doublefeature.fm. You can do stuff on that. All the links to all the things are on there.
There's a Sockulapalooza.
It's true. We got a patreon.com/doublefeature, the name of the show. You can go on there and make sure the show keeps going and we get to continue poking at movies. I'll tell you where the barometer is for me, is that I expect an audience to at least think about the movie for the length of going out and having a cup of coffee afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
If an audience is not willing to do at least that much thinking, I've accepted that segment of audience as completely lost. Anybody who needs everything wrapped up by the time they stand up before the credits have started rolling, I just gave up on those people. So we want to keep having our cup of coffee with you guys and hanging out and talking for... Oh, we already know the answer. It's 24 minutes. You'll meditate on a film for exactly 24 minutes. And then, okay, so we should go back in time to when the show began because we already have the fucking answer. Mm-hmm. It takes 24 minutes to everything you can learn about a film in that amount of time, nothing further. Anyways, speaking of, what are we doing on the show next time?
We got 2 films next time. We're going to do 2 films. They're kind of crimey, heisty films. We're going to do a film.
Is this a thing? Hold on. Is this as a result of one of our Patreon subscribers?
Ooh, it kind of is. Yeah.
Is it perhaps Aaron Shore, Ben Ucker, Charles Crawford, David Anderson, Jordan Sells, Abbott of Unreason, Mark Abbott? How many fucking Abbotts are in this? Keisha, Tom Leonard, or Athena Banks?
It's none of them.
Wow. So even people who subscribe at a lower level than executive producer can recommend a movie for the show.
That's true.
That's great. Sorry, please go on.
One of the films that we're doing next week is a film I recommended for the show. That's a film called The Nice Guys.
Mm.
And then
Nobody cares about your recommendation. Get to the meat.
I'm not going to tell you until next week, but someone out there in Podmanity listener land recommended a Walter Matthau film called Charlie Varick.
We'll find out next time.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.